You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is Walk the Talk with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. In these podcasts, I will be talking with people who share their stories of tragedy and hope. I will be exploring mental health and well-being with workplace professionals and also with folk who struggle to make sense of their own lives. My hope is that these shared experiences will remove the loneliness from those people who are convinced it is their fate to suffer alone. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been a police officer for over 20 years. You're very welcome to join me on Walk the Talk. In the April of 2013, my guest suffered a traumatic mental breakdown that would cut short his career as a police officer. He chose to write about that experience, and in 2017, his book Blue, a memoir, Keeping the Peace and Falling to Pieces, was published. Searingly honest, sharing police work in a way perhaps no one has ever done before, and the toll that it took on him, it quickly became a bestseller. He became somewhat of a celebrity within the policing and well-being world, and was soon in demand as both a public speaker and commentator, both on radio and television. He regularly travels to other police forces across the country and continues to contribute to the police well-being debate. More recently, he's highlighted the effects of the many years of cuts to policing budgets and how it has affected the policing ability to tackle crime in the 21st century. John Sutherland is in reflective mood as we discuss his own policing experience and his new book due out in May this year called Crossing the Line. I'm delighted to say he joins me now. John, a very warm welcome to Walk the Talk. I suppose the most important question to start with today, and indeed the most compassionate one to ask, is how are you today?
It's a very kind question to ask, and the answer is I'm well today. I'm a man on a journey, and every journey has its ups and its downs, but I in many ways I think I'm probably more well than I've ever been in my life.
And I suppose the reason I specifically asked about today is because mental health is not linear, I guess, and I wonder how you cope with your less bright days.
There's a kind of a personal answer to that, and there's a practical answer to that, and it's a constant learning process. I've got a friend who's retired from policing who has long had PTSD. He describes it as something that he had to learn to live alongside. So not something that he ever fully recovered from, but something that he learned to live alongside and learned to live contentedly alongside. My diagnosis is a bit more complicated than that, I think. There's some PTSD in there, but there's lots of other stuff too. And I guess I'm learning to live alongside it. But in three really practical ways, I managed to stay pretty well. The first is just learning how to rest in a world that's moving far too fast. It was Gandhi who said there's more to life than increasing its speed, but I don't think anyone was listening. And the world just seems to be going faster and faster and faster and faster. We want our food fast, and we want our broadband fast, and we start doing our pieces if the internet signal on our phone or laptop starts buffering, and we hate waiting for buses and trains and planes, and we all just went and got in one big hurry. And the ability to rest is becoming something of a lost art, I think, and one that I'm having to rediscover. Second thing is learning how to talk. When I first had my breakdown nearly 7 years ago now, I was referred for emergency counselling, and I got my 6 sessions on the NHS, and they were brilliant, but 6 sessions is never enough. Not if you're seriously ill. And I was incredibly fortunate, my wife and I, that we could afford for me to continue to see the same counsellor privately. And I kept on seeing Anna for more than 5 years after my breakdown happened. And I'd go back and see her now in a heartbeat if I needed to. And we don't all need that level of professional assistance over that length of time. But absolutely, it's one of the oldest truths of them all that it's good to talk. I mean, I've learned that there's nothing to be gained from taking the stuff of life that is difficult and burying it away somewhere deep inside and hoping that's it dealt with, because it will find its way out in the end, because we're human beings, not machines. And so learning how to talk and how to keep talking is my second trick. And then the third thing is learning how to follow sound medical advice. First thing I did when I woke up this morning was take an antidepressant. Done that every morning for the last 7 years, and I'll do it every morning for the rest of my life if I need to. And the important thing to say is that I'm not ashamed of the fact. But if I'm honest, the first couple of times I said that out loud in public, I take antidepressants and I'm not ashamed, the person I was most trying to convince was me. Because there is still this remarkable sense of stigma attached to mental ill health, and perhaps to depression in particular. It's still one of those subjects that we think is probably best not mentioned in polite company. Let's keep it tucked away, out of view. But the reason I'm not ashamed, because there's nothing to be ashamed of. And the analogy I often use to explain to people is I've got two younger sisters. They're both extraordinary. The middle one has had cancer twice in her life and survived both times. And most recently, she had thyroid cancer, which meant that she had to have her thyroid removed, which means that her body now no longer naturally produces something called thyroxine. Now, I'm no great medical expert, but I understand that's pretty important and would be a real problem for her were it not for the wonders of modern medicine. She can take something each day that makes up for what's missing in her body and allows her to live an otherwise completely normal life. And so the question comes, why should it be any different for my head? It would appear that there's something missing up there. I often say if you talk to my family, they'd tell you it's more than one thing that's missing. And that would be a problem for me were it not for the wonders of modern medicine. I take a single little white tablet each morning that seems to make up for at least part of what's missing and allows me to live an otherwise healthy, happy life. So why would I hesitate and why would I be ashamed? Just the one footnote on medication is really important to say, particularly when it comes to antidepressants, is that they don't work for everybody. Or they don't work for everybody in the same way and to the same degree. But they do work for a lot of people, and they work for me, and they're part of how I stay well.
And it's an important point you raise, isn't it? Because mental health does have some physical characteristics which are dependent on chemicals in the brain. And as you say, some people, that for those chemicals are missing, and medication is essential.
Absolutely. I think the thing is, as a society, we don't understand mental health nearly as well as we understand physical health. So if I was to line up in front of us now three people with broken legs, their stories might be slightly different. One of them might have been playing sport. One of them might have slipped down the stairs. Undoubtedly, one of them would have been drunk dancing on a table and fallen off it. You know, there'd be three different causes. And the actual nature of the break might be slightly different. You know, one of them might have done their femur, one might have done a tib and fib, one of them might have a complex fracture. And again, the treatments might be slightly different. One of them might have rods and pins, one in plaster, one in a moon boot. So you've got slightly different causes, slightly different symptoms, slightly different treatments. But at the end of the day, they're all broken legs. More or less, we understand what a broken leg is and what to do about it. And it's helped enormously by the fact that we can just put an X-ray up on a screen and you can see exactly what's happened. But if I was to line up me and two others with subtly different forms of mental ill health, where would we even begin in terms of understanding the causes and understanding the nature of the illness and understanding the most effective forms of treatment. Because, of course, none of it shows up on x-rays. So as a society, we're still learning. This is still very much a developing conversation, which is one of the reasons why it's so important to be having it out loud and in public.
And I'm just wondering whether it's a fear of mental health. You go back 100, 150 years where people with mental health issues, and sometimes as a result of that would have committed crime, they'd all be committed to the local asylum. And the only treatment would be to lock them away from the wider public. And I think that was a lot of fear and not understanding the conditions.
Couldn't agree more. And I think there's something in human nature that we tend to be afraid in particular of things that we don't understand. If we can't quite explain it, if we can't quite control it, it tends to make us afraid. That's certainly my experience. You know, what happened to me 7 years ago was the single most terrifying thing that has ever happened to me in my life. And that was at least in part because I didn't understand what it was and I couldn't control it. It swept me away and took me to the very edge of life.
And I suppose when you've gone through that, you were probably thinking, I'm the only person that's suffering and feeling the way that I do.
Mental ill health can be hugely isolating because it's all internal. There's nothing really you can see. I mean, you know, in the early days of my illness, I lost a lot of weight and I wasn't looking after myself as well as I could. And so there might have been some things physically that you could see, but most of it's on the inside. Most of it's hidden away. And absolutely, it felt to me as though I was the only person in the world. Because I have told a little bit of my story in public, I have the extraordinary privilege from time to time of hearing other people's stories. And either they'll come up and talk to me or they'll drop me a line via a DM on Twitter or an email, whatever. But it's an enormous privilege to hear people's stories. And I always respond by saying, look, before anything else, I want to make you two promises. Promise number one is that you're not on your own. And promise number two is that you will get better. And I'm able to make those two promises because I know them to be true from my own experience. But in those early days of my illness, I felt completely alone and there didn't seem to be any prospect of ever getting better. It felt like the end of all things.
And I guess it's a two-way thing, isn't it? Because if people are sharing their stories with you, then their getting better will rub off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Which, you know, back round to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, it's why talking is so important. It gets things up and out into the air, into the open, rather than leaving them hidden away inside, covered with fear and shame.
Well, that very nicely brings me on to your first book, really, I suppose. And you described it, or you described policing as a painful privilege. And I think it's a phrase that I think says more than anything else about the work that we do. I just wonder whether at some point in your own life you realise that everything comes at a price and a emotional transaction, if you like.
I think probably the most significant realisation for me over the last 7 years of my illness and slow recovery, the most significant realisation would be this. It's that it would be impossible, not unlikely, not improbable, impossible to do the job of a police officer for any length of time and to remain untouched, unaffected by the things that you see and the things that you do. But I'm not sure, well, certainly 7 years ago, I'd never heard that talked about. I'd never heard it suggested because it's just the job, isn't it? You know, you used to be a traffic officer. I think of my colleagues in traffic turning up to their third fatal in as many weeks, picking their way through a scene that is beyond the comprehension of most ordinary people. And you catch up with them at the end of an interminably long shift and you might say to them, how are you doing? And you'll be met with a shrug of the shoulders. And they'll say, well, it's just the job, isn't it? It's what we do. And yes, it is. And I'm enormously proud of the people who do it. But let's not pretend that it's ordinary. I run out of words to describe how proud I am of the women and men who do that job, do the job. But let's not pretend that it is in any way ordinary. And I still think that policing is the finest, greatest job in the world. I still think that it's the most extraordinary thing that any of us could ever choose to do with our working lives. That's the privilege of it all. That precious old-fashioned thing called duty, that opportunity to help people to change the world.
And that's the important thing, though, isn't it? We do normalise it, I suppose, in a way to cope. And it's really important sometimes, I think, that we just stop and tell ourselves exactly that, that it is not normal.
Yeah. Andy Rhodes, your chief constable, was talking last year and drawing a comparison between the number of occasions on which people in ordinary walks of life are exposed to trauma compared with police officers and paramedics. And I might not get the numbers exactly right, but I'll get the gist of them right. Most people in the course of an ordinary life will be exposed to severe trauma on something like 3 or 4 occasions. And frankly, that's 3 or 4 times too many. Police officers and paramedics during the course of their working lives will be exposed to extreme trauma on anything from 600 to 800 occasions. 3 or 4 times in an ordinary life, 600 to 800 times in a policing life. Now, how can we possibly pretend that that is without consequence? Mm. You know, you can't be a police officer for any length of time and remain untouched, unscathed. And it's really important to say that I'm not making a complaint here. If I had my time over again, I would do it all again in a heartbeat. I just might approach some of it a little bit differently, understanding now some of the potential costs involved. You can't continue to absorb trauma indefinitely and not feel the consequences of it.
We talked earlier about mental health, didn't we, and about living with it. And when you said that, I thought, well, that's very similar to bereavement, isn't it? Sometimes you never really get over the death of somebody close to you or a loved one, and you do learn to live with it. And that made me think about work of family liaison officers that support families. And it takes a bit away from you, and you leave a bit of yourself with that family.
That's the very real human sense in which every contact leaves a trace. I talk a lot about the faces and the places that I've encountered during the course of my policing lifetime. You know, there are faces and there are places that I will carry with me for the rest of my days. I think of Kojo and Ben and Milad and Dogan, 4 boys, in one case a young man, in 4 different London boroughs, who lost their lives to knife crime on my watch. And I will carry their names and their faces with me for the rest of my days. In many ways, actually, I count it a privilege in my own small way to be able to keep their memory alive. The one thing I can't do, though, is pretend they're not there.
I did a podcast last year with a friend, a good friend, Will Hogan, who described being the night detective. And he dealt with the death of a 5-year-old child, which caused him a lot of problems, which has taken him a few years to get over. The doctor said to him that you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You could have gone to that same incident any other day of the week and you would have been fine. And I'm just wondering, have you ever felt that you were in the wrong place at the wrong time?
I think that I thought that I was invincible. I think that, you know, call it youthful naivety, call it whatever you want. I just think that I thought that I would always have within me whatever it took to cope with whatever life threw my way. And if I'm honest, I don't think it was even a conscious thought. It was just an assumption that I'd always be able to keep going in the face of whatever challenge came, whether it was personal or professional or a combination of the two. And I guess one of the many things I've learned is that actually I'm not invincible, that I've got my breaking points. And in fact, that all of us have. You know, the point I was making earlier, none of us is designed to absorb trauma, human tragedy, without limit. We all have a finite capacity for these things.
Not only we're not designed to take trauma, but it's the speed at which it hits us. You know, the workload of officers now is relentless, and nobody's getting arrests just to reset.
I've said this publicly on a number of occasions. I think these are the most challenging times for policing in this country since the end of the Second World War. And, you know, that's not a sort of carefully crafted soundbite designed to get a reaction. It's just, it's a simple statement of fact. And it's because, number one, crime is rising. Certainly crime of the most serious kinds. You know, we're hearing that knife crime is at its highest levels ever. There's, you know, as we sit here now, there's been a news story within the last week about murders of women being at their highest level in a decade or more. You know, crime certainly is rising, but it's not just crime. Demand is rising too. Demand on police officers, hugely and significantly, as a consequence of the almighty great gaps that are appearing in the delivery of every other frontline public service. Mental health is the one that most often gets mentioned, but actually it's right across the board. The whole criminal justice system, but the broader public sector, all of it is under strain, and it's police officers who are picking up the pieces. So crime is rising and demand is rising, but complexity is rising too. You know, the job is infinitely more complicated than it used to be. You know, you work in child abuse investigation. Just the impact of technology as both an enabler of crime and an accelerator of harm. You know, when I joined, we filled out our crime reports on bits of paper. I mean, literally on A3 sheets, which we then filed in a ring binder. Now, policing's always been pretty complicated by nature of the job, but technology in particular has made it infinitely more so. So crime is rising, demand, complexity, and risk. Risk, from where I sit now, sort of one step removed from policing, I am seeing stories of more police officers being more seriously injured more frequently than at any point I can remember. All of these things are on the increase precisely at the time where resources have fallen to their lowest levels in a generation. Between 2010 and 2018, we lost 44,000 officers and staff from policing in England and Wales alone. 44,000. I mean, it's a telephone number. And we're in a situation now where we've got fewer officers with fewer resources doing a job that's more difficult, more demanding, and frequently more dangerous than it's ever been before. And to your point about no downtime, I mean, I think that's, you're absolutely bang on. I'm always slightly nervous about drawing comparisons with the military because, you know, it's a very different job, but that's not to say that there aren't things we can learn from their experience. You know, if you're deployed on a six-month stint in Afghanistan, before you're allowed home, you go through a period of what the military call decompression. They recognize that you can't just step off the battlefield and into the family home, that actually there's a period of adjustment that's needed, personally, professionally, psychologically, in every respect. And they call it decompression. And I think it's sort of 2 weeks at the end of an operational deployment. And then even then, once decompression's over, you return to a period of retraining, re-equipping, refreshment. There's absolutely no equivalent for that in policing. So you think about the PCs and the DCs on the front line, who are the heart and soul of policing. By some distance, the most important people in policing. And it's just relentless for them. And this idea of decompression or downtime, it doesn't exist within our, you know, within something as basic as the shift pattern. Mm. Two earlies, two lates, two nights, four off, and every now and then work an extra day for aid or for training or for whatever else. But there's no such thing as downtime or decompression routinely built into the shift pattern. Mm. And actually, given what we're beginning to understand about policing and the demands it places on people, that's something that we need urgently to put right.
So in your first book, you described in great detail the effect the price had in your own life. And in fact, we've been talking about that. I'm just curious, who did you write that first book for?
Well, I didn't set out initially to write a book. it's not something I ever sort of dreamed or imagined I'd do. You know, when I first had my breakdown, there were probably 2 to 3 months where I was so ill that all I could do was breathe in and out and make it to the end of the day. I mean, quite literally. It was just hanging on to the ragged edges. But there came a time where I began to get a little bit better. And I got to the point where I thought, maybe I will get back to work one day. I knew I wasn't ready, but at least the possibility was there. And so I sat down at the kitchen table and I thought to myself, I need to get my brain going again, because it had completely shut down. And so I sat at the kitchen table and just started writing for 10 or 15 minutes at a time, just as a means of trying to get my brain turning over again, as a way of just trying to ease my recovery along. And that's all there was to it. I wasn't thinking about a book. I wasn't thinking about anything else. I was just thinking about getting my brain working. And of course, what I then discovered quite quickly is what an awful lot of people discover, is that writing is enormously cathartic. And having discovered that, I then discovered that I loved it. Having never done it before, having never thought about doing before, I discovered that I loved it. So to answer your question, I think initially I was writing for me as a means of getting better. Then I was writing for my dad, my late dad. He read a very early draft of something that I'd written before he died, and he loved it, and that would have been enough. But with Dad gone, then I was writing for my daughters, just something that they might have after I'm gone, just an account of what I did with my working life. And I guess just slowly, it wasn't any sudden moment, just slowly I began to wonder, well, is there potentially a wider audience for this? Is there some wider benefit in what I'm doing? And I'd started blogging. I guess that was my way into proper writing. I started blogging and people had started to read what I was blogging and responded to it in ways that I'd never anticipated or expected. And so I guess there came a moment where I thought, well, let's have a go. I was having a private conversation with a national journalist. It was just him and me over a cuppa, off the record, just talking. And we talked about all sorts of things. But at one point in the conversation, he looked at me across the table in the coffee shop where we were. And he said to me, John, who's standing up for policing in this country? And it was a kind of semi-rhetorical question, but it was abundantly clear that he didn't think anyone was. Mm. You know, this was at a stage where there was an all-out political attack on policing. There was an all-out media attack on policing, or certain sections of the media. It was as austerity was beginning to bite. And, you know, you'll remember, I certainly remember, they were tough times. And the prevailing conversation about policing in the kind of the public space was just a relentlessly hostile one. Mm. The police are racist. The police are incompetent. The police are corrupt. Well, do you know what? Sometimes we are. Some of us can be. And I don't ever think we should grow tired of holding policing up to the light, you know, holding policing accountable. The issue I had was that there was no balance to the story being told. And so I guess in some small way, in my own way, I wanted to try and redress the balance. I wanted to tell the stories of the heroes I'd spent my working life alongside. So in the end, I suppose Blue, my first book, as much as anything, was a love letter to policing.
When I found out that we were doing this podcast, I have to confess that I was concerned I would struggle to find areas of interest that haven't already been covered in the many interviews that you've done since the publication of your first book. So I put my cold case review head on and went back to the beginning. Chapter 2 of your first book, Before Coppering, describes your childhood. Now, many of our early experiences continue to echo through our adult lives. How would you describe your own childhood?
It's not particularly dramatic. You know, I often say to people, there's nothing especially interesting in my backstory. I had a fairly ordinary childhood in a town 40 miles outside of London, never getting in much trouble, never writing any real headlines. One of the more significant things in my childhood that becomes more significant with the benefit of hindsight was the fact that my dad suffered with mental ill health. My late dad had bipolar disorder. They used to call it manic depression, which is a particularly difficult, challenging, painful form of mental ill health. But it didn't register much in my early years because Mum and Dad hid it from us. I think that was partly a generational thing, partly a cultural thing, partly a keeping up appearances thing. And so I'm not sure how consciously aware I was of it, certainly in the first half of my childhood. During my teenage years, I guess increasingly so. And then when I was 17, my parents split, and the year later they divorced. And, you know, that's an experience common to, gosh, almost half of us, I suspect, these days. But I do know that it had a devastating impact on me. And specifically in relation to my dad's mental health, you know, it does raise the question of biology, of genetics. You know, am I somehow predisposed to suffer with mental ill health because my dad did? And the answer is actually, I don't know for sure. And neither does anyone else, even the leading experts in the field. Because the more we understand about mental ill health, the more we realise we don't understand. But it's a possibility. Maybe nature played some part. And if not nature, then nurture. You know, to some extent, I'm the product of growing up in a home where my dad was seriously ill and my mum was seriously struggling to cope. And at a very young age, or certainly by the age of 17, you know, I kind of by default became the man of the house. I had two younger sisters and my mum. And nobody told me that I had to, but at some level, subconsciously and even a little bit consciously, I took it upon myself to look after them. I somehow thought it was my responsibility to make sure my mum was okay, to make sure my sisters were okay. And maybe that's part of what attracted me to policing in the first place, is the instinct to want to help people.
I sense some contradictions in that chapter. You beautifully described your father as your hero and loving him was unavoidable. And yet you also describe an endless set of rules and haunted by guilty feelings of never quite being good enough.
Your dad was a remarkable dad in so many ways. He was the one who spent hours out in the local park playing football with me. He was the one, on occasions more than my mum actually, who would look after me when I was ill or when I got knocked off my bike. He was the one who drove me to the hospital for x-rays. In many ways, he was a remarkable dad. The kind of the guilt and rules stuff, that was less about him and mum directly individually. It was more about the Christian religion that we grew up with. So dad was, certainly in the first 7 years of my life, was a vicar in the Church of England. You know, I was the Sunday school kid who knew all the right answers to the right questions because dad was the vicar. But I grew up with a form of religion that just, whether it meant to or not, just imposed a whole set of rules and expectations that somehow I had to earn God's approval by being good enough, by keeping the rules. And I do remember living a lot of my childhood and even my young adult life with just this relentless sense of guilt that I wasn't good enough, that I just didn't match up to the expectations. And I, you know, of course, mum and dad played their part in that, wittingly or unwittingly. But it was a broader consequence of religion rather than any one specific thing my parents did or didn't do. And, you know, fast forward 30, 40 years, you know, one of the consequences of my breakdown was actually, in a very positive way, the loss of that religion. But the discovery or the rediscovery of a deeper faith, a thing less man-made and bound by rules.
Your new book, Crossing the Line, is due out in May this year. What are your ideas behind the latest publication and how does it differ from your first book?
Crossing the Line, I think, is the book that I was trying to write before I wrote Blue. I remember sitting in the borough commander's office at Southwark, and it was after reports had come in of a particularly horrendous crime. I mean, I guess in its own way, no more or less horrendous than hundreds I'd come across before. But I do remember particularly being struck by this crime. Maybe I was reaching my capacity. Maybe I was close to my breaking point, and somehow this had more of an impact on me than others. But I remember sitting there thinking about the detail of this offence. It was a rape of a teenager committed by a teenager in public, in broad light of day, in the stairwell of a block of flats. And I remember thinking, gosh, most of the world outside of the police station, most of the world outside of policing has no idea about the stuff that's going on. You know, part of the painful privilege of policing is to see all of life and all of death and everything in between in a way that's not filtered by the media or carefully crafted into a politician's soundbite. It's just raw life and death as it really is. And I remember sitting there in my office thinking, have I got some sort of a duty, some sort of a responsibility to tell the world out there about the world that policing inhabits and reveals? But 4 or 5 years ago, I don't think I was ready to write that book. I think I needed to tell my story before I told any others. But Crossing the Line is a simple attempt to tell people out there about the things that police officers see and the things that police officers do. So it takes 10 of the biggest issues and challenges we're facing as a society. So from alcohol and drugs to knife crime, terrorism, mental health. 10 chapters on 10 of the biggest issues of our time, and offers a policing perspective on each of those things. The things I've seen, the things you've seen, the things that our colleagues have seen. That kind of raw understanding of how life can be for people out there. And it's a book that I hope doesn't flinch from the truth, but also offers some hope. I refuse to believe that there aren't things we can do about the murders of boys on our streets. I refuse to believe that there aren't things we can do about the murders of women in their own homes, about child abuse, about human trafficking, and so the list goes on. So it's a raw book, it's a real book, but I hope it's a book of hope too.
You very kindly sent me the foreword to your new book, and I think I read somewhere that you described the flimsy police tape as a physical barrier between sort of police world and general day-to-day public life. And that struck me as a brilliant analogy, in that there was a barrier there, yet it was such a flimsy one. And although the two separate, completely different worlds, they are so close together that most people don't realise just how close that world is on their doorstep.
And that, in one, is the heart of the book. And hence the title, Crossing the Line. There's the idea that this blue and white tape flicks in the breeze at the scene of the latest crime or car crash or whatever today's catastrophe happens to be. And it is flimsy, insubstantial, and yet it establishes something solid and impermeable, a line between the world that we inhabit and the world that police officers inhabit. And as members of the public, you know, we might pause for a moment and stare at women and men in blue forensic suits, fingertip searching for clues. We might ask a question. We might wonder what's happening there. But we always move on in the end. You know, we resume our lives, leaving them to theirs. And I guess the book is an invitation for people just to linger a little longer. To cross the line from the side of the tape where the public stand, and to stand for a while on the side where police officers stand, to see how life and death really can be.
I know we talked about this earlier, but the drip-drip criticism of police in the media, some of it is justified, but despite all that, the police continue to enjoy high levels of confidence, and the public continue to be fascinated by the work that we do. What do you think is behind that?
It's the greatest job in the world. You know, I'll never grow tired of saying that. For as long as I live, I'll be more proud that I can ever say that I was a boy in blue. You know, policing is adventure. Policing is all of life and all of death. And I'm repeating myself, but everything in between. And I do think that people are fascinated by that. I also think that the silent majority understand the value and the importance of what we do. I also think the silent majority understand the extent to which policing is more stretched than ever before. I think the silent majority remain enormously grateful to the everyday heroes and heroines who police our streets.
Now, the 10 particular challenges that you've raised in your new book that do face society in the 21st century, I'm just wondering, when you were writing your book, whether you identified any common themes between your chapters that perhaps link them?
Yes, is the short answer. And so let me give you one example, potentially of many. But it's of the impact of trauma. But in particular, the impact of childhood trauma on adolescent and adult offending. So one of the murders I dealt with in West London nearly 15 years ago now, when it happened, it was part of a whole spate of murders that were happening across London. And there was a general kind of air of concern. There was hand-wringing in the press. Have the police lost control? Calls for more stop and search, more enforcement, tougher sentences for those caught carrying knives. All of those things that remain so familiar as knee-jerk reactions to violence. And I and my colleagues in the local authority and the sort of the wider statutory partnership, we weren't content just to respond in the ways that we always had done. We wanted to look deeper. And there were a group of 12 or 13 individuals, teenagers, kids, who were believed to have been there or thereabouts when this boy was murdered. And we wanted to look into their backgrounds. And so we got every bit of information from every possible source, from every possible agency, to try and paint a picture of their backgrounds, their life histories, to see if we could begin to understand whether there were any common threads in their stories. And of course, the results that came back were, on the one hand, utterly shocking, and on the other hand, not surprising at all. Most of them came from broken homes. Most of them came from poor households, so low levels of socioeconomic income, etc. A significant number of them had a history of exclusion from education. Some of them had older siblings who were involved in crime. But the one thing that stood out to me more than any other, it remains one of the most significant discoveries, realizations of my whole professional life, was every single one of them, there wasn't an exception, every single one of them had grown up in a violent home, witness to or exposed to or even victims of domestic violence. There was no exception. Now, it's important to say in a broader sense that not every child who grows up in a violent home goes on themselves to become violent. The reality is much more hopeful than that. But if you look at it the other way round, kids who are being caught up in violence, 14-year-olds who have been convicted of murder, in my experience, in almost every case, almost every single one of them has themselves grown up in a violent home. Now, back, 10, 15 years ago, we didn't really have language for it. These days, we would talk about adverse childhood experiences. I would never for one moment seek to excuse the actions of a criminal, and certainly not of a murderer. We make our choices, and we have to live with them, and we have to be accountable for them, and we have to face the consequences of them. But I would try to understand, because that's the only way of hoping to prevent it happening in the future. We live in a society, both culturally and politically, that is enormously impatient. We want quick fixes to everything. Knife crime, let's fix it by Friday. And so often we resort to those same monotonous calls for more enforcement, tougher sentencing, which in the short term have some value, but in the long term are not the answer to anything. So if there's one consistent theme that emerges in so much of the new book, it's about understanding the deep underlying long-term causes of offending behaviour and understanding, therefore, in the need to invest in long-term solutions.
Now, the internet has become an intrinsic part of the 21st century living and, more crucially, the way we access it, I suppose, via the mobile phone. As the police are criticised for becoming less and less involved in the community, perhaps due to austerity and other reasons, I'm wondering if society itself has an important part to play in essentially rebuilding itself.
Yeah, you know, we're sitting talking in London, one of the biggest, busiest places on earth, and yet also one of the loneliest. That very simple fact and realisation presents a challenge to the world that we currently live in. John Carnican, one of my heroes, one of the co-founders of the Scottish Violence Reduction Unit, makes a wonderful point. He talks about the fact that human beings are born connected. I mean, quite literally, umbilically connected. I was born umbilically connected to my mum. We are made for connection. And John's point is that it's when disconnection occurs that problems arise. And it's ironic, you talk about technology, in one sense the claim is that we are better connected than ever before, but whilst that might be true technologically, I'm not sure that it's true humanly. I think in fact potentially the reverse is true, that, and I, you know, I don't want to come across as some old kind of Luddite, you know, I've got a smartphone and I benefit from the use of it and they're not all bad, but I do think sometimes the thing that we most need to rediscover is old-fashioned human connection. Actually, fundamentally, a huge proportion of the problems that we encounter as a society are due to the loss of connection, the breakdown in connection. Mm. And people are out there looking for places to belong, somewhere to call home. That's one of the reasons why boys join gangs. It's one of the reasons why girls flee to Turkey and cross the border to join ISIS, because they're looking for connection, because they're trying to repair the broken connections. They, in most cases, won't be conscious that that's what they're doing. But we're all searching for family, for a place to call home.
Finally, John, as we draw to a close, and maybe it's a sign of me getting older, I look around my own police station and see many of the officers who seem so young yet now have old heads due to their own policing experiences. We've talked earlier, the role has never been harder, never more complex, and expected standards never higher. And like you, I'm full of admiration for these young people. So how can we prevent previous mistakes in looking after these officers and ensure that their mental well-being is looked after?
Short, simple answer. Policing needs three things. Given all that we've learned in the last decade or so, given all the conversations that are now going on about mental ill health, we need three things. Number one is we need really effective crisis care. And this, generally speaking, is the thing that policing tends to be a little bit better at. We're better in a crisis in almost every respect. But on a day where London Bridge happens or Westminster Bridge happens or Manchester Arena happens, the crisis care provision needs to be world class, and it needs to be maintained over time. It's not good enough just to do the NHS six sessions. Sometimes people are going to need support and care for years after events like these. So crisis care is the first thing we need to get right. The second thing we need to get right is routine care. So you and I, as policing colleagues, talking about our mental health should be as natural and normal as talking about career development or promotion or transfer or annual appraisal. We need to normalise the conversation. you know, given what I said earlier on, it would be impossible to be a police officer for any length of time and to remain unaffected by what you see and do. And for precisely that reason, we need to ensure the routine provision of care and support for our colleagues, and not just wait for the day when, God forbid, the bomb goes off or whatever else. And then the third and final thing, the thing that policing is always worst at, we need world-class prevention. If I was to sit down with a group of recruits now and, you know, be asked to say a few words, there's two things probably I would say to them ahead of anything else. Number one, I would say, welcome to the best job in the world. Welcome to the adventure of a lifetime. And I'd mean it with all of my heart and soul. But the other thing I might well say is, at some point over the course of the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, there will be moments, there will be days where you are stretched to your very limits and probably beyond. And it's better that we tell you about that in advance. And it's better that we do everything that we can to prepare you for it in advance. So here are a set of skills, a set of tools to help you for what will inevitably come your way during this adventure of a lifetime.
Well, John Sutherland, I've enjoyed my time with you today. It's been an absolute privilege. Thank you.
Thanks very much.